of cosmologies around the world in terms of the understanding of their understandings of the relations between relationship between human beings and God, the supernatural, for example. This is when you saw monotheism emerge all over the planet, for example. And also conceptions of human agency, possibility for free will and the independence of the individual to change their social and their personal circumstances. So these are the deep roots of the conception of human agency. So I think the question now is whether in a period of enormous stress during the 21st century, we're going to see something like a second axial age. There are opportunities for a very rapid transition in humankind's conception of itself. In some sense, you might say that we need to move from a stage of adolescence to a stage of adulthood, a stage where we think of ourselves as invulnerable, our time horizons are very short, and we're trashing the place, to a stage where we live more wisely on the planet. And my source of hope, I suppose, would be that this is a kind of paradigm, as you would say, or worldview transition that spreads globally in our highly connected world, a recognition that not only do we have to live more lightly on the planet, we have to live more fairly. We've got to remember that 40% or so of the world's population is still living in desperate poverty. And there's not going to be any compact to deal with things like climate change unless we have fair economic and social relations on the planet. It's a tall order, because I think in times of scarcity, the natural tendency for human beings is to retreat into their tribes and to their identity groups and get ready to fight each other. But there's just a possibility, and this is where my hope resides, that we'll choose a different path this century. Because I'm not a big believer in the essential nature of human characteristics, intrinsic human nature. I think we're actually highly plastic creatures in terms of our responses to our environment. And we may just pull something quite extraordinary out of the hat this time in these extraordinary circumstances this century.
Thomas Homer Dixon, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thomas Homer Dixon is the founder and executive director of the Cascade Institute at Royal Roads University in Victoria, British Columbia. Through the complexity lens, Homer Dixon studies social, economic, and ecological instability and how people and societies can thwart threats and promote virtuous cascades. He's written various books, The Upside Down, Environment, Scarcity, and Violence, and The Ingenuity Gap. His most recent work, Commanding Hope, The Power We Have to Renew a World in Peril. Read more about all this at greenplanetmonitor.net. Of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases has warmed Earth's surface by about 1.1 degrees relative to the late 19th century at a rate of about 0.3 of a degree per decade since 1980. That rate is steadily rising. As Earth's surface warms, thermal expansion and melting ice sheets have raised sea levels by 0.2 of a meter. That rate is rising too. Slow and steady for years to come? Think again. In a 2023 report, a team of scientists warned about tipping points, inflection points, where Earth warming and the destruction of Earth's living fabric become nonlinear and unstoppable, and where Earth systems start shifting to new, potentially dangerous states. 25 tipping points were identified in that report. 5 major ones may already have been transgressed. More could soon be tripped, the report's authors warned, triggering a cascade of amplifying feedbacks across Earth's interlocked climate system and biosphere. Globalized human economies and societies will inevitably suffer, as if all this weren't scary enough. Quote, "There is no adequate global governance at the scale of the threats posed by negative tipping points," unquote, the report's authors warned. Manjana Milkerit was one of them. Milkerit is a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Oslo and lead author of a chapter of the report about tipping point governance. The GPM reached Manjana Milkerit in Oslo. What are tipping points?
Tipping points are specific features of what we call complex systems. The way we are using them in the report, especially when we're referring to climate tipping points or Earth system tipping points, we refer to the fact that the Earth system has major subcomponents that have what's called multiple stable states, so they can exist in very different constellations or configurations, and that under certain circumstances, they can move rather rapidly and irreversibly for a certain time period from one stable state to another. So that's not a very frequent occurrence, but it is possible that it happens. And then if the conditions are right, a small change in that system can trigger what we call self-sustaining feedback mechanism. So the change process keeps propelling itself forward. That creates nonlinearity, rapid change towards the second alternative stable state. And so we have a phenomenon that is rare, that is relatively fast, that cannot be stopped once it's started, and that leads to a fundamental change in the nature of the system we're thinking about. So, for example, if you think about the Amazon rainforest, that one can change from being in its current, for a very long time, stable rainforest state towards a much drier and very different grassland kind of state. So that would be characterized by very different plant and animal life. That would be characterized by very different hydrology and possibility for living. So these are just very different, what we call system states. That kind of flip from one state to another is possible for all the systems that we try to characterize in this report, whether it's ice sheets or ocean currents or seagrass meadows or glaciers and so forth.
And there have been 25 different tipping points identified. Some are associated with the cryosphere, with the icy surface of planet Earth, others with the biosphere, and others with ocean atmosphere circulatory patterns. Can you quickly review some of these?
So we said more than 25, I think specifically 26 different candidates for tipping processes have been identified. The report assesses many more systems and even shows us how confident we are in whether or not some of these are not tipping elements or cannot have this kind of nonlinear behavior. But yeah, so I think the key distinction here is, as you said, between cryosphere, biosphere, and kind of ocean atmosphere circulation systems. The cryosphere, we have major ice sheets and glaciers. Also permafrost is a component of the cryosphere. So we know that our major ice sheets can undergo these nonlinear transitions between their ice sheet stage, which has been the reality on planet Earth for hundreds of thousands of millions of years, and they can go to a non-existing ice sheet state. Of course, that transition might also take a very long time, but relative to the existence of the ice sheet, that is a short period if it happens within 2,000 or 3,000 years, for example. So the ice sheets can undergo that kind of transition. Then we have in the biosphere key examples. I've given you one already. The Amazon rainforest could die back and no longer be a rainforest. We also have other forests, the boreal forests in the northern latitudes of the world. We have another important biome that's at risk already today, and that's the coral reefs in the warm water areas of around the world. And then the third major system, which is the ocean atmosphere circulation systems, there we have things like the Atlantic overturning circulation, abbreviated as the AMOC, that has been of concern. Also some more recent, recently added systems like the North Atlantic subpolar gyre. And then in the atmosphere, we have monsoon systems that could undergo such tipping processes.
And these systems are coupled so that if, in theory, if we exceed one tipping point, if we pass one tipping point, we enter into this cascading process where other tipping points get engaged. And all these kinds of effects cascade through not just the climate system and the living world, but through human societies and global economies.
That's right. So there's two things to distinguish, I think, and it goes back to what we started with, the fact that we're talking about systems and things are connected. So these different components of the Earth system are connected to each other in important ways, and we're still studying which ones are linked to which ones and how they influence each other. Sometimes they can have stabilizing effects on each other, but sometimes they can also, as you said, increase the risk of triggering one another. So those connections between different Earth system tipping systems are being studied in terms of cascading potentials. But then we also have the connection between these Earth systems or natural systems and human societies. And there are multiple connections, lots of them. These environmental systems provide the conditions, and currently still stable conditions, for human life, for everything we do, for how we breathe, what kinds of food we can produce, where water is available, what kinds of materials we have available to construct our settlements, where we live, actually all of our social conditions for life, how we feed ourselves, how we clothe ourselves, what we do is conditioned by the environment. And once you start thinking about these currently stable conditions flipping to alternative states, that becomes very, very worrying. So there are lots of different kinds of impacts that we anticipate from these change processes, and these impacts differ significantly depending on the tipping point or the tipping system we're thinking about. So, for example, impacts would be very different from the die-off of the coral reefs compared to the melting of ice sheets or the release of the permafrost. So different impacts are expected, but they all would be severe and possibly destabilizing for society. So we also look into the potential of accelerating change or negative social tipping points as a consequence of Earth system tipping points.
And one of the repercussions that you talk about in your paper is the collapse of world food production in wheat production and in grain production.
So we point out that, for example, the collapse of the AMOC would significantly alter temperature and moisture availability in certain grain-producing areas of the world, and that could be global scale significance.
And the AMOC is the Atlantic?
That's the Atlantic overturning circulation, right? One of these ocean major ocean circulation patterns that regulate temperature and moisture and storm patterns and so forth around the Atlantic. So yes, we point out that that could have significant consequences for the ability to grow major staple crops around the world. That's just one example of how the impacts of these tipping processes are really severe and need to be considered at this point by our global decision makers to make sure we try to prevent them. This is really our key strategy, should be the prevention of passing these tipping points, because their impacts could be so significant, diverse, and around the world. One challenge that we have, of course, with these tipping processes is to distinguish to what extent are these impacts different from the general and well-understood impacts of climate change. We do know that tipping points can contribute to accelerating climate change itself by, for example, additional release of greenhouse gases. We're accelerating warming with some of these tipping processes. But tipping processes do have their own distinct set of impacts that differ from the well-understood impacts of climate change. And that's one reason, for example, why we are pointing to the fact that our existing governance frameworks for adaptation, for example, or for loss and damage need to be revisited and rethought in the context of our knowledge about tipping points. So we need to reassess our vulnerabilities, the exposure to tipping point impacts in different places around the world, to make sure we are prepared for these impacts or potential impacts. Of course, we're hoping that we can still prevent these processes from happening, but to the extent that they do come to pass, we need to be prepared. We need to increase the resilience of our societies, adjust our systems accordingly, and then deal with those consequences. And that might, as I said, require different approaches than we currently have in place, because these current plans and frameworks do not consider the specific risks of tipping points.
You write in your report, currently there is no adequate global governance at the scale of the threats posed by negative tipping points. There is no adequate global governance.
That's right. So currently we have a lot of institutions in the world that address climate change and other sustainability issues, but they're all designed without actually considering specifically the risks of these nonlinear large-scale tipping processes that I would suggest really require a different kind of logic, or in many cases now adjustment of these existing institutions to account for these additional threats that are at a scale we haven't faced before. And so the institutions we have, try, for example, the UNFCCC, are all attempting to address the threat of climate change. And every instrument we have in that toolbox, from trying to address mitigation, so reducing greenhouse gases, to adaptation, to loss and damage, to finance, all of these need to be revisited, in many ways strengthened, to address these increasing risks of tipping points. And that starts with the reconsideration of the global temperature goal. So our current global temperature goal says that we want to stay well below 2 degrees Celsius and have an aspirational additional goal to make efforts towards 1.5 degrees. But our report says we're already at this current level of warming at risk of triggering 5 tipping points. So 5 tipping points already are, or tipping elements, are in a state where they could be triggered at any moment. Maybe the chance isn't that high yet, but the chance of triggering those will increase significantly once we surpass 1.5 degrees of global warming. So this is really where we're increasing the risks for these severe global scale changes with potential cascading effects. And so we're arguing strongly that 1.5 needs to be the only viable temperature goal left. We might even have to aim lower than that if we truly want to minimize the risks of passing tipping points ultimately. And we are very soon about to surpass the 1.5 degrees of warming, maybe within the 2030s. And so it really becomes imperative to rethink the mitigation pathways that allow us to draw temperatures back down to or even below 1.5 degrees. So we need to start thinking about minimizing peak temperature, minimizing the overshoot period above 1.5 degrees, and drawing temperatures back down with carbon removal technologies. So that's one set of implications, for example, for the existing governance structures that we have, that we suggest for how they can be used and adjusted to account for these specific risks of tipping points.
Well, the term global governance seems to me to be an oxymoron. I mean, looking at the way the international community has dealt with the Russia-Ukraine crisis and the inability of the Security Council to just agree on a ceasefire in Gaza, it seems that global governance is it's almost like a contradiction in terms. Governments are, the most powerful ones are competitive, acquisitive. They seek power and money. There is no rule of law. There's rule of law for official enemies and not for our friends. And global governance seems to me to be anything but cooperative. The way governance works today in the world seems to me to be antithetical to what's required to actually, look after Earth systems.
So, of course, the starting point for any efforts to address global challenges, whether that's in the domain of conflict, international conflict between states, or in the domain of the environment, like we're looking at right now, the climate or Earth system tipping points are often placed within this domain of environmental issues. Starts from, internationally at least, from a place where we have a system of sovereign states, where every state is not bound by law like we are in national contexts. They're sovereign. They get to do within their territory at least what they want. And then we have developed over time systems of international relations, international institutions to address or at least try to address some of the problems that occur in such a system of independent countries. And that, of course, in terms of conflict, that often is a domain where resolution is the most difficult. And it follows often also different rules, and we see more cooperative approaches in other institutional domains like development or the environment. And governance, I also should say, is more, way more, at least in our definition, global governance contains more than just a relationship between states. So, for example, in the context of climate change, we have, of course, lots of institutions that where countries come together as governments to try to cooperate to address climate change, like in the UNFCCC, but also in other international institutions. But then there are many more actors involved than just governments. So there are also non-state actors. They have lots of corporate and industry actors who do, to some extent, self-governance or private governance or rulemaking for industries within industries or economic actors and domains. There also are a lot of civil society actors that play an important role. Civil society actors often try to mobilize to change what countries do, but they also try to change what private and industry actors do. So there are lots of NGOs involved. Also, sometimes individuals can make a difference. So we have a huge range of actors at different scales of action that are involved in doing what we call governance, which is a term for saying collective efforts to address joint problems, to shape our collective patterns of behaviors, to create norms and behaviors and rules and regulations to fix those challenges. And sometimes those governance efforts are more successful than in other cases. But I think it's important to keep different problem domains separate and to assess how good or bad are we in making progress towards one or the other. As I said, in conflict, international conflict, violent conflict, that is a very different challenge compared to the problem we have here in terms of climate change, where we basically are trying to address the fact that the way we've built our societies and our economies has this initially unexpected but global scale impact on how the Earth system works. And it's pushing us towards different states of the Earth system that are not very conducive to social stability and human well-being. So we need to address that, and that's what we're doing within the climate regime, I think, and within the larger space of what you might call global climate governance.
So you write here, existing governance institutions and decision-making approaches need to adapt to facilitate transformational change. What would this look like? How do they need to adapt? And what would transformational change kind of look like in the context of global governance? And there are these various terms that you use in your paper, anticipatory governance and polycentric governance and no regrets action. Can you talk about some of these?
Yeah, so we outline a whole number of approaches for how existing institutions, especially the UNFCCC, can be adapted or adjusted to take account of the risks of climate tipping points or Earth system tipping points. But we start with kind of a discussion of what should be the general principles for governance of such a kind of problem. So these are kind of two different avenues to take. So first of all, what types of logics or ways of decision making or thinking should guide governance for tipping points, which are nonlinear large-scale processes that we haven't really tried to address before? And then what does this mean in the context of these existing institutions to move forward? We also look into the fact that given that these tipping processes are at large scales, but affect, of course, multiple scales of human organization and social life. So tipping systems are usually at a scale where they cover multiple countries or even a whole continent. So you could have a global scale for these. You could have the regional tipping point scale governance. There's a national scale that matters for decision making relating to those tipping points because certain drivers of these tipping points exist at the national scale. And then there are also, of course, impacts at local and individual scales. So there's governance approaches will need to cross multiple scales and try to ensure that there's cross-scale coherence and interactions for our efforts to address tipping processes. So that's one of the big frameworks we suggest that, of course, we need to look at this through a multi-scale lens, and that has to do with what we call polycentric governance. We do emphasize that given the very challenging temporal dynamics of tipping processes, governance should be much more anticipatory, which means future-oriented or forward-looking, than most of our current governance approaches. So our dominant frameworks in global governance tend to take maybe a number of years or maybe a decade into the future perspective at a maximum. So we see that, for example, within the Paris Agreement, we have this tool that's called the NDC, the Nationally Determined Contributions, where countries are supposed to submit promises and pledges for what they will do over the next 5 or 10 years. But when we have tipping processes, we know that these unfold over much longer time horizons. and that we want to understand how to prevent them and how to deal with their impacts, we also have to be able to take into account these much longer time horizons. But they are not only long time horizons, they're also short ones. So we need to really understand how decisions that we make within the next 5, 10, maybe 15 years collectively can or cannot prevent some of these tipping points that can then lead to changes, if we don't prevent them, could lead to changes over hundreds or thousands of years. And so being able to grasp these temporal dynamics that connect short-term decision-making to really long-term impacts and deal with that requires much more anticipatory tools, both in terms of how we develop knowledge, the kinds of decision-making frameworks that can assess distant future threats, medium-term threats, and near-term threats that come with tipping points and put them all into a decision-making framework, the kinds of, let's say, normative or ethical frameworks that we use to understand the, let's say, the responsibility of actors living today for preventing these tipping processes, because for some of these, only this generation of existing decision-makers or people alive can actually prevent tipping processes. People who are born today or who will become decision makers in the 2030s or 40s will no longer even have the chance to prevent these from happening once we've triggered them. So there's a significant weight on decision makers today to reconsider what it means that the prevention of some of these tipping points is in their hands and their hands only.
Manjana Milkereit is a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Oslo in Norway and lead author of Chapter 3 of the first Global Tipping Points report released back in November 2023 during COP28 in Dubai. Listen to our complete conversation and link to that report at greenplanetmonitor.net. That's it for today's GPM, a listener-supported podcast coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions in the Netherlands. Listen to, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. Find us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and our home base, Blueberry. We're also on Canada's Harbinger Media Network. I'm David Kattenberg, over and out for now.
Thank you. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM Radio. Burnaby. Bum, 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 bum.
This is Bird Note. Swans in flight, immaculate white on glistening wings, magnificent birds of such size that their wing strokes seem to flow in slow motion. Finnish composer Jean Sibelius wrote about this scene in his diary in April 1915. These were whooper swans migrating north to Finland. The composer was entranced by both the sight and the sound of the swans. He watched the swans depart like a gleaming silver ribbon, he wrote, and declared the image one of the great experiences of my life. Sibelius transformed the breathtaking natural moment into music. The swans' undulating wings and tremulous voices carried the central theme of his acclaimed Fifth Symphony, a theme written just after the swans flew over. Swans have charged composers' imaginations again and again. There's Tchaikovsky's Swan Lake, And 20 years earlier, Sibelius himself had written The Swan of Tuonela, a tone poem that captures the quiet grace of a resting swan. It was nature's simple elegance that inspired Sibelius, A Flight of Swans. For BirdNote, I'm Michael Stein.